This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that allows you to control and manage your own healthcare and choose any doctor or hospital in the nation. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free healthcare, call now 855-585-4237 or go to libertyhealthshare.org.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. The UN Secretary General recently warned that anti-Semitism is alive and well in today's world, noting that he was shocked a few years ago to listen to the chant of a group of neo-Nazis in a developed country chanting blood and soil, the slogan of the Nazis. This is the former head of the UN's refugee agency, who has also talked about the need to combat anti-Muslim discrimination. But when it comes to the poison of anti-Semitism, where is the discussion of the role that anti-Semitism plays within mainstream Islam? We're going to talk about that today with Dr. Andrew Bostom, an Islamic scholar and the author of The Legacy of Jihad and the Legacy of Islamic Anti-Semitism. Today, we'll be discussing an important article that he's published over at PJ Media, How Mainstream Islam Threatens Jewish Existence. Dr. Bostom, it is great to have you here. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Janet. And as always, you had an excellent segue. That sort of illustrates the point that I wanted to make. Although the immediate spur to this particular piece, which frankly may be the last time I deal with the subject, it was this campaign. I mean, it was a noble effort by, I think it was originally started by some filmmakers in Germany, and then they got the sponsorship of the government. But the idea was that somehow, you know, you can't disguise the raw Islamic Jew hatred that's occurring in this so-called refugee population that's coming into Germany.
Right.
It's just, you know, it's very obvious. So what they're trying to do to mollify it in some way is do these concentration camp visits that are preserved, you know, to remind the German population of the Nazi era. And one of them is at a camp that was called Sachsenhausen. And so there's a description in the Washington Post of bringing an alleged refugee from Syria to one of these memorials. Even this experience does not somehow, temporarily suppress his raw hatred. He just sort of, you know, spews out that the direct perpetrator of the violence in the country that he allegedly is escaping from, you know, the region Syria, was because of Israel. And then the money quote for me was, he said, the Arabs think that what Hitler did was a good thing because he freed them from the Jews. It so captured the deeply ingrained hatred that I felt that I had to broach this subject once again. And the reason that I think the evidence is overwhelming that it's coming directly from mainstream Islam, and that it's this is the source of the broad, really, I think it's a pandemic,
yeah,
is a medical term of Jew hatred, is because if you look at how Islamic institutions define themselves as being mainstream, there was a big, much to do about this response that came out of something called the Royal Islamic Strategic Center in Amman around the time of the Regensburg Address by then Pope Benedict. And it was really a response to that. But its charter calls it its mission to preserve and propagate traditional Orthodox moderate Islam as defined by the International Islamic Consensus and this Amman message that they claim to best represent traditional Orthodox and moderate Islam. And their goal is to propagate it. Hmm. Well, every year they put out this publication called the Muslim 500, which in their estimation are the top 500 most influential Muslims in the world. And each year that list differs. But one thing that remains consistent over at least the last 5 years that I examined was their definition of traditional Muslims as representing 96% of the world's Muslims, fundamentalists representing 3%, And so that's 99% of the world's Muslims. We're so-called modernists. And to me, those are the Muslims that we would actually, you know, look to integrate into the West.
Right.
Those represent, by their definition, less than 1%. And they deal with them with ridicule.
Ugh.
Because these modernists actually feel that the Sharia itself should be reformed, which,
right,
of course, it would need to be to integrate Muslims into the West.
Right.
But they're being ridiculed by this mainstream Islamic organization. And then you jump ahead to who is number one on their list this year as being the most influential Muslim in the world. And it's I think it's a totally appropriate choice. It's the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar University,
yeah,
who's Ahmed Al-Tayeb. And then when you Al-Azhar really is the Sunni Muslim Vatican. When you look at the statements that he has made, recent statements that are just rife with core Islamic anti-Semitism. There's a verse that he explicated on Egyptian TV. It comes from the fifth chapter. It's the 82nd verse in the Quran. And it basically describes how the Jews have been the Muslims' worst enemy. And then he says his gloss, his interpretation on this verse, this is, again, the Sunni Muslim papal equivalent.
Yeah.
This is an historical perspective which has not changed to this day.
Huh.
See how we suffer from global Zionism and Judaism. Since the inception of Islam 1,400 years ago, we have been suffering from Jewish and Zionist interference. And, you know, the Quran said it, history proves it.
Yeah.
And he goes on and quotes from the verse, you shall find the strongest among men enmity to the believers to be the Jews.
Incredible.
And, so Janet, ask yourself and your audience, ask themselves, what would have happened if Pope Francis made a statement like this, just basically reiterating, you know, the deicide allegation or something like that as being how, you know, all Christians in the world should think about Jews. It's just absolutely incredible. And his predecessor, Ahmed Al-Tayeb's predecessor, his predecessor's foundational work, this was Sheikh Tantawi, who died of a heart attack in 2010. His ticket to elevated status in Islam was this massive 700-page tome called Jews in the Quran and the Traditions. And, you know, I just want to give you a flavor of what he says in this. He says the Quran describes the Jews with their own particular degenerate characteristics, i.e. killing the prophets of Allah. And he quotes appropriate Quranic verses from the second surah and the third surah. And then he describes their permanently corrupting traits. Putting words in the wrong places, consuming the people's wealth frivolously, refusal to distance themselves from the evil they do, and other ugly characteristics caused by their deep-rooted lasciviousness. Only a minority of the Jews keep their word, and he says the good ones become Muslims, the bad ones do not. And he actually cites a Quranic reference for that, which is accurate. But he even goes on to talk about, you know, how they could be exterminated. Once they go so far as to ban their religion, their persons, their wealth, and their villages. I mean, so these are two successive Sunni Muslim papal equivalents, just, you know, glorifying these traditions. Tantawi met with the chief rabbi of Israel in 1998, and he had a whole discussion of how the dialogue is really to poke an eye and poke a stick in the rabbi's eye. In 22, he cited a Quranic verse where the Jews are the apes and pigs. This is from the fifth surah. He legitimized homicide bombing against Jews. And he actually referred back to his thesis, which originally published in 1966 to 68. And he says, this is fast forwarding to 1998. He says, my stand stems from Allah's book, the Quran, more than a third of which deals with the Jews. I wrote a dissertation dealing with them, all their false claims. I still believe everything written in that dissertation.
Oh, my good.
I mean, Jan, you can't make this up. It's so bold.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, we have the same thing, you know, don't want to bore your listeners, but the same thing comes out of the bastions, the mainstream, most authoritative institutions of Shiite Islam. And I give an example of the greatest, you know, 20th century Shiite intellectual, probably of all, you know, in the entire century, and his massive Quranic commentary, which, you know, reiterates the same sort of theme. And you have the attitudes of the Muslim world as documented by the Anti-Defamation League.
Hang on a second. We're going to run to a break. We'll be right back with Dr. Andrew Boston picking up our conversation where we're leaving it off. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. We'll be right back.
Here is today's Capitol Hill Brief with Concerned Women for America President Penny Nance.
Friends, hear me loud and clear. Every child, every person has intrinsic value as created in the image of God. Can you stop and consider that? Every person you meet stands as a monument to Almighty God. How can we disregard any because of race or creed or nationality, or as we've highlighted this week, because of a disability? In the United States, 67% of babies diagnosed with Down syndrome are aborted. 67%. We can do better than this. Every parent I've ever met that has a child with Down syndrome cannot cease to praise and give thanks to God for their child.
Join the fight to defend the unborn and give them the right to live. Every life matters, and we want to see laws passed that uphold these values. Visit CapitolHillBrief.org to fund the fight today. That's CapitolHillBrief.org. Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and on behalf of Janet Mefford Today and the Ministry Preborn, we'd like to thank you for helping us reach our goal of giving 300 babies a chance to live, but the need is still great. Nearly 1 in 4 pregnancies end in abortion, and there are more moms to reach and more children to save. So if you haven't had a chance to donate, there's still time left. You can sponsor 5 free ultrasounds for just $140. Simply call 855-601-BABY. 100% of your gift goes toward saving babies, and all gifts are tax deductible. That's 855-601-2229.
From Affirm Films and Provident Films, who brought you War Room, comes All Saints. New pastor Michael Spurlock, his struggling congregation, and a group of refugees come together, trusting God as they plant seeds for a future that might just save them all.
Start a farm, work together, and save the church.
All Saints, starring John Corbett. Now playing. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. More information is available at allsaintsmovie.com.
We're back on Janet Mefford Today. Thanks for joining us. One thing that really needs to be drilled into our brains is the fact that the media and the culture at large is trying to, I would say, suppress the truth about Islam on a lot of fronts. But one of the main things we need to recognize is the anti-Semitism that we see rising around the world is certainly fueled by Islamic doctrine, and not just radical Islamic doctrine of a certain type that's very, very small. But in fact, as my guest, Dr. Andrew Boston, points out, this is part of mainstream Islam, and we're really not getting the straight scoop. If we want to deal with anti-Semitism, we really have to discuss the role that anti-Semitism plays within mainstream Islam. And you were talking about this, Dr. Boston, some of these Al-Azhar figures who have talked about the Jews, what they really think of the Jews based on the Holy Book, all the rest. This is something you also said is out of authoritative Shiite Islam. And yet you do, and when you mentioned the Pope, I immediately thought of something that you talked about in your article here at PJ Media. That was the fact that Geert Wilders really had to kind of correct Pope Francis and say that when Francis was making the remark that, oh, you know, this is just not mainstream Islam, and he's making a little bit of an apology for Islam not being violent and all the rest. And Wilders says, you know, this claim that authentic Islam and the proper reading of the Quran are opposed to every form of violence is just not based on reality.
Exactly. And of course, the predictable reaction to Wilders pointing this out. And by the way, I just, you know, not to toot my own horn, but he is a colleague and friend, and God bless him. I mean, I brought this to Geert's attention, the comments made by Ahmed Al-Tayeb in light of what the Pope had said.
Great.
And he's the only politician in the world, the United States, Europe, anywhere, who actually followed up with my suggestion. Please, Geert, you know, you're the only one that has the courage, say something. And he wrote this beautiful letter to the Pope. I would urge your listeners, you know, to read it. But you're absolutely right. He gently chastised the Pope. And went through, you know, Geert is one of the only politicians in the West, the only one that I certainly know of personally, who has actually studied Islam.
Yeah.
It's very similar, you know, going back to the era of Tocqueville. You know, Tocqueville studied Islam when France was having its interactions with the Muslim world. And it's remarkable the parallels that you see. Tocqueville, and of course in his era it was not a big problem to say this. He after he studied the Quran, he studied the first, I think, about 20 surahs or chapters. He says that the first of all religious duties is to blindly obey the Prophet, that holy war, jihad, is the first of all good deeds. All these doctrines, of which the practical outcome is obvious, are found on every page and in almost every word of the Quran, are so striking that I cannot understand how any man with good sense could miss them.
Good grief.
I mean, and unfortunately, Wilders seems to be the only man with good sense amongst our political class in the year 2017.
It's true.
But you're absolutely right. I thought he actually did it rather gently. And the other person that I point out, who I happen to know personally, and it just shows you how terrible state of denial of the Jewish community. There's one rabbi in the entire United States who has had the guts, and he's suffered for this, to confront the doctrinal anti-Semitism in mainstream canonical Islam, and that's Rabbi John Hausman. And it turns out, of course, the rabbi is fluent in written and oral Arabic. He actually studied in Cairo, and he's vilified by his fellow rabbis for basically having open discussions about this horrible content.
That's crazy.
And the other thing is that you can actually see studies now emerging, very, very gingerly from Europe, where I give these academics credit. They try and soft pedal it a little bit, but they're pretty clear that when they look at the anti-Semitic attitudes, particularly of Muslim youth in Europe, it's clearly coming back to their understanding of these thematic elements of Islam that are virulently anti-Semitic.
Right.
And you have it in this country too. I mean, there was the case of two California imams recently highlighted, one of whom was citing this canonical hadith, this tradition of Muhammad, which calls for the annihilation of the Jews to usher in the end of times. I mean, these are Muhammad's words. They're
yes.
not in the Quran. They're in the traditions, but they're at least as important in many respects as the Quran. And, you have the example of Muhammad literally being the person wielding the sword, executing, beheading 600 to 900 Jews. Again, according to the Muslim most authoritative biography of Muhammad, these are the Jews of the Banu Qurayza. And before he does that, while he's besieging them, he uses a Quranic epithet. He calls them, sons of apes and pigs.
Mm-hmm.
These are the examples, and then you see these horrific data that the ADL, which doesn't want to deal with the doctrine, but at least publishes what I would say is the result of the doctrine, 2 to 3-fold worse than any other ethnic religious group on the face of the earth are the Muslim virulent attitudes towards Jews, the most anti-Semitic. They actually scale it in the ADL. So, six and above is the worst part of their scale. Those are the attitudes that are prevalent in at least 50% of the Muslims in the world.
And they
dwarf that level of anti-Semitism in any other ethnic group, religious group that's been looked at.
It's so scary when you consider how, relatively speaking, how short a time has passed since the Holocaust. I mean, this was before I was born, before a lot of people who are listening were born. And yet, even in my younger years, it was always about never forget, never forget, never forget. Well, now people are acknowledging this rising tide of global anti-Semitism. And certainly we have to look at what you've said about what mainstream Islam is teaching about Jew hatred. But what about this issue that you raise in your article, that the continued denial of Islam's mainstream canonical Jew hatred and the global Muslim attitudes it fosters will facilitate the jihad annihilation of Jews, but it won't end with their elimination alone? This is a very strong statement with which I wholeheartedly agree. How do we get people to heed this warning? This is just so troubling what's going on.
I you're not going to get any help from the Jews, unfortunately, Janet. That's why I'm so glad to speak to you as an open evangelical Christian and the evangelical Christian community. I don't know whether it's some of it is raw fear. I can tell you, when my enormous tome came out on Islamic anti-Semitism, and I was, I did get invitations to lecture to Jewish audiences. They went from shock to fear. And then the fear, unfortunately, would translate in, there was like projection. They would get very angry with me.
Wow.
And, I think a lot of it is fear. And some of it is denial. You know, the Jewish community was very bad at recognizing even Nazism. They were still railing about the Tsar when, you know, when the Soviet communists had eliminated the Tsar. They always seem to be dealing with prior enemies, but, and also they've been terribly indoctrinated with this phony notion of a Muslim Jewish symbiosis during the Middle Ages, as if that was even relevant now. But believe me, this comes up all the time. It used to come up in my lectures. Not only is it false, even if it were true, it has absolutely no relevance to what's going on now.
Right.
But I think a lot of it is just raw fear. The Jewish community does not want to deal with this. And, you know, they shut down discussion of it. That's obviously, you know, not going to help.
No, it's not going to help. And you have such a big group of more liberal, politically speaking, liberal Jews in this country who are very committed to the progressive agenda. Well, part of the progressive agenda, as we've seen with this intersectionality, is that oppressed peoples need to come together. Therefore, you have to have all these disparate identity politics groups. And a lot of people would say, well, Islam, you know, we need to stand up for the oppressed Muslims, and this faux concept of Islamophobia, that has been such an effective propaganda tool, I think, Dr. Bostrom, for people to shut their mouths and to not tell the truth about this.
Absolutely. And this horrible conflation of this phony notion, Islamophobia, with anti-Semitism, which is just Jew hatred. I mean, you know, the word is an inappropriate word. You know, Semites or Semitism, if it exists, is a group of cognate languages. It has nothing to do with Jew hatred.
Yeah.
Jew hatred is Jew hatred.
Good point.
So it's an unfortunate term. But, you know, it's interesting when you go back to this so-called benevolent Middle Ages, one of the great scholars of Muslim-Jewish relations and a serious scholar, Shlomo Dov Goitein, pointed out that the Jews themselves in Egypt in the period roughly between the 10th and 12th centuries had already coined a unique word to describe the hatred that Muslims bore towards them specifically, not the sort of general, you know, anti-infidel attitudes, but there was a specific word that was coined to capture this hatred. And so it's not, you know, it's not, and there was a great Muslim polymath during the Abbasid period who was asked actually to commission an anti-Christian polemic. The reason was Al-Jahiz. He was asked by the caliph Al-Mutawakkil to do this because Al-Mutawakkil, being a wise ruler, understood that the masses hated the Jews more than the Christians, and yet the Christians had still thriving empires at that time. The Armenian Christians had an empire. The Byzantines had an empire. They were a political and military threat. The Jews were crushed and living under the Sharia, and yet the attitude that this ruler knew was that the Muslim masses hated the Jews more. And he actually, Al-Jahiz, actually wrote in his essay about this that it was being motivated by the same verse that, you know, what is it, 1,000 years later, Ahmed Al-Tayeb, the current Grand Imam, is citing Quran 582 and also the turbulent relationship between Muhammad and the Jews. So this was already characterized by Muslims themselves in the middle of the 9th century. So what does this have to do with Nazism? What does this have to do with medieval Christian anti-Semitism? Nothing.
Yeah.
It's a separate, independent, very, very ugly tradition.
Well, it is. And you've given us such good food for thought. I really want to encourage everybody to read this article. It's called How Mainstream Islam Threatens Jewish Existence. You can find it at pjmedia.com. As always, Dr. Bostrom, it's an honor to talk to you. Thank you so much for imparting your wisdom to us.
Thank you very much.
You are so welcome. God bless you. And we'll be back right after this. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that allows you to control and manage your own healthcare and choose any doctor or hospital in the nation. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free healthcare, call now 855-585-4237 or go to libertyhealthshare.org. on Janet Mefford today. Wow, what a week it has been. And we continue to pray for the victims of Hurricane Harvey. It doesn't look like it's going to be cleaned up anytime soon. People continue to suffer down there in Houston and across the Texas Gulf Coast as the weather continues to move in and be bad for lots and lots of people. Continue to pray for these people. But I just am so interested to get some of the thoughts from Penny Nance, who is CEO and president of Concerned Women for America. She is joining us now. And I know CWA has been very involved in trying to be there for the hurricane victims. Mm-hmm. Penny, welcome. It's great to have you back.
Well, thanks so much for having me back again. Boy, this is a hard topic.
Yeah,
today.
I know. It's just been stunning. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on this entire catastrophe, how it was handled, how the people are responding, and everything else.
Well, you know, the cautionary tale in this kind of situation is always Katrina, of course.
Of course.
Where the federal government was very slow to act, where the state of Louisiana and certainly the local government in New Orleans was just in complete disarray. And so when you look at that, this seems completely different. I was on the phone with a briefing, and there's been other briefings today from the White House. Kellyanne Conway briefed us all, I believe it was yesterday, about what efforts are going on. Of course, the president and the first lady went down there and were immediately involved. And so there's still, you know, there's still questions about the way things are going to work out with FEMA and what should be done right away. And and I would just say, if anyone's listening, the first thing that needs to be done, you have to register with FEMA. So any victims that are listening from Texas, make sure you get online and register with FEMA as soon as you can, as soon as you get to a place where you're able to do that. But, you know, Concerned Women for America has about 22,000 members in the state of Texas. So it's a very big state for us. It's a big state for not only members, but also donors. So this is, you know, a state that we feel very close to. My state director, Dana Hodges, lives in the Houston area, and her house is deeply flooded, and she had to be rescued by boat to get out of it.
Oh, no.
And so, and there's others, many, many others. I was inundated with emails and texts from people that are members and donors from down there. And, you know, some of them, things are going great. Some of them, not so much. And so we are staying very much involved. But what we are hoping to do, and this is something that happens not right at the front end, right? This is something that has to happen a little bit further down the road once the waters have started to recede and people are able to go back in. And that is what we did in Louisiana about a year ago or a year and a half ago when they had their major flood. And we are working with our state ladies in conjunction with a church, with other churches, to give out very small gift cards for Walmart, very like $10, $20 increments that just will help people at the very, you know, at that moment before there's any kind of insurance reimbursement or anything like that, just to help them access, you know, cleaning supplies and mop buckets and, you know, a change of clothes, a new toothbrush, whatever they kind of need just for the moment. Okay. And that's what the state of Texas, I called my contacts within the state government's office, and that's what they said was needed right away. So that's what we're asking people to give to. That effort, we have flights from our state director, our national field director, that's going to go down there, and we will be, as the weeks and months go by, mobilizing our volunteers to go in and, you know, be Jesus's hands of, you know, helping rip out carpet or, you know, it's the kind of thing where the community comes together. And let me just say, there's no other state, I think, in the union that's better poised to be able to do this. And we're already seeing it with people with their own boats going to help. This is not a state that expects, they're not, you know, that quote unquote waiting for Superman.
Right.
They are taking care of their own, and they have to, because there's no way any government, a federal or state government, can meet all these needs. It's too big. It's too horrific. And the state of Texas is very well poised and just philosophically poised to be able to lean in and help each other, neighbor helping neighbor. And that's already happening.
Yeah, it was so interesting because I saw a video online today, and it was a video of a highway. And then on the shoulder of the highway, there was a line of pickup trucks all of whom had boats hitched to the back of each and every pickup truck. And somebody said, I think that Texas ought to erect a statue to regular guys with bass boats.
Oh, my goodness.
Isn't that great?
That beautiful picture, that big strapping Texas man, you know, in camouflage, carrying that pretty young mom with her little baby off of the boat is, you know, it's kind of etched in my mind, and that is Texas.
Yeah.
Those big guys with their bass boats and camouflage that have hearts as, you know, as big as the state of Texas.
That's right.
And that is the people of Texas. You know, my state director Dana, before her house went under, was out filling up sandbags. For the community, because that's what they do. And so it is going to be a long struggle to come back, but I have every confidence that state will come back. We need to pray for them. We need to give monetarily, and we need to give of our elbow grease. We need to, you know, be willing to go help out.
Yes.
And to, you know, partner with churches and organizations like CWA to all willing to come alongside and help out when that time comes. Again, we're all at the front end of this, you know, and so it's going to be a long process. It's not the kind of thing that we can jump in. At some point, you know, in the beginning, you have all these people that want to help, but they can't help yet. It's not time yet. But
right.
There'll be something for everybody to do as things progress.
Excellent. And I know that you are looking toward a 15,000 funding target in the next 24 hours, giving those gift cards as needed to purchase essentials for victims of Hurricane Harvey. Will you give out that website, Penny, so people know where to go if they'd like to help out?
Yes. Yeah, so come to concernedwomen.org, and there's an opportunity there to help. We're also to Capital Brief. And we really, you know, again, this is money that will go to the victims in little increments. You know, it's not going to be big gifts. It's little gifts to help with those felt needs right away that just, you know, it can make a difference. It makes a big difference. We heard a lot of great feedback about it when we did it in Louisiana, and people were like, you know, that's exactly what I needed.
Oh, that's fantastic. ConcernWomen.org and also CapitolHillBrief.org, as we always tell you about the great Capitol Hill Brief website for Concerned Women for America. I was curious, too, Penny, to get your take, because I know the former Joint Task Force Katrina Commander, Russell Honoré, was on CNN. He was very critical of the federal government, and why weren't they more mobilized? Why didn't they get ahead of the storm? Why weren't they here? And I thought to myself, you know, you can talk about the logistics and everything, but, you know, is this too much faith in government? Like, it's the government's job to make sure everything in my life works swimmingly, not to coin a phrase that's inappropriate given the circumstances.
Mm-hmm,
but what are your thoughts on that, saying the federal government should have been here faster?
Shocker, the guy from Katrina's trying to throw shade on what's happening now.
Yeah,
really?
Yep.
Come on. I mean, that was it was the Bush administration. This is not a partisan topic. The Bush administration fumbled badly.
Yeah.
The Trump administration was immediately involved and poised, but this is hard, and it's catastrophic, and it's huge. And, you know, the people in Texas, there's going to be mistakes, but the people in Texas and the first responders, we even lost a first responder who drowned.
Awful.
I mean, the people are fully engaged. FEMA will do FEMA's job, but FEMA is not God.
Exactly.
And government is not God. And it is going to take work from the local, state, and federal government, but it's going to take a lot of work from all the volunteer organizations and all the churches to open their doors and do their part. But this is the way it's supposed to work. I mean, nobody in their right mind sits in their house waiting for President Trump to come save them.
Exactly.
Or they shouldn't.
No.
And
no.
And so, you know, it's a long process, but everybody has to do their part. And, you know, I think people who blew it so horrifically because if you remember Katrina, it was days and it was weeks and weeks before the federal government really got involved, and you had people flying over. Meanwhile, there's stories, if you're old enough to remember this, Janet, and I am too, in which people are at the Superdome in New Orleans being violated.
Yeah, it was awful.
Being preyed upon.
Yeah.
It was horrific.
It was really
was. Almost in there. So
I know.
A different story.
It sure is.
Everybody has guns, by the way.
I know. Well, concernedwomen.org, if you'd like to get involved and help with this gift card distribution, please go there, concernedwomen.org. Penny Nance, thank you so much, Penny.
Thank you, sister. God bless.
You too. We'll be right back.
Are you unhappy with some area of your life? Perhaps your job, where you live, your family, or friends? This is Jeannie Niger with Unshaken. I found a key that will change your life. Instead of starting out each day dwelling on what is not right or what I don't like, I choose to pray like this. Thank you, God, for divinely orchestrating every single detail, interaction, and conversation today. Thank you for opening up doors to share my faith. Thank you for enabling me to partner with you to release your plans and purposes today. When my focus shifts from my plans and problems to His plans, life becomes exciting and joyful. I grow in intimacy with God, which enables me to stand strong, regardless of the circumstances. For more on how to remain unshaken in a world that's all shook up, or to download a free chapter of my book, Unshaken, Standing Strong in Uncertain Times, go to jeannienigro.com/Janet. That's jeannienigro.com, JeannieNigro.com/Janet.
Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and on behalf of Janet Mefford Today and the Ministry Preborn, we'd like to thank you for helping us reach our goal of giving 300 babies a chance to live, but the need is still great. Nearly 1 in 4 pregnancies end in abortion, and there are more moms to reach and more children to save. So if you haven't had a chance to donate, there's still time left. You can sponsor 5 free ultrasounds for just $140. Simply call 855-601-BABY. 100% of your gift goes toward saving babies, and all gifts are tax deductible. That's 855-601-BABY. 601-2229.
From Affirm Films and Provident Films, who brought you War Room, comes All Saints. New pastor Michael Spurlock, his struggling congregation, and a group of refugees come together, trusting God as they plant seeds for a future that might just save them all.
Start a farm, work together, and save the church.
All Saints, starring John Corbett. Now playing. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. More information is available at allsaintsmovie.com.
This hour of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you in part by Sony Pictures, All Saints. The inspiring true story of Pastor Michael Spurlock, starring John Corbett. All Saints, in theaters now. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. More information is available at allsaintsmovie.com. Well, it was just weeks ago that the skinny Obamacare repeal bill failed in the Senate, and as frustrated as we all are that Obamacare has not yet been fully repealed, what is coming next might be worse. We're going to get some thoughts on it now from Dr. Meryl Matthews, who is resident scholar with the Institute for Policy Innovation. Dr. Matthews, great to have you here. How are you?
I'm doing well, Janet. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, the Washington Post, I know, recently lauded the fact that no counties in America now lack Obamacare exchange insurers. And apparently we can all breathe a sigh of relief. Obamacare is working. Trump doesn't know what he's talking about. What is your take on this triumphant announcement that there are no Obamacare exchange insurers that are missing anywhere in America?
Well, first off, the media is looking for anything positive it can say about the legislation because it's always supported it. But secondly, the real fact, the real key element there is a lot of pressure put on insurers in various counties to try to step up, so some of them did, to provide one. But we only have 47% of counties, as it stands right now, will only have one health insurer operating in the exchange, and the administration has given them through the end of September to decide whether or not they're going to be in it. So we could see some more dropouts. We could see some more step back up. We don't know which way that's going to go. But it's a long way from the competition and lower prices that President Obama promised us when you've got nearly half the country has only one health insurer in the exchange, and a lot of those are there from arm twisting.
Right. It sure doesn't give you any choices. If you have one choice, that's no choice at all. Now, do you see that number probably rising from 47% to include more situations like that where there's only one operator in the exchange?
Oh, I think that's the path we're on. And some of it will depend upon whether or not President Trump continues with the cost sharing subsidies. There are in the law. In Obamacare, if a lower income person applies for a health insurance policy and a middle income person applies for the same policy in the same area, the lower income person is liable to have lower out of pocket co-pays and lower just out of pocket cost because what happens under the law is the insurers will reduce that person's out-of-pocket cost, and the federal government is supposed to subsidize the insurers for doing that.
Right.
That's in Obamacare that the government will do it. However, the Democrats, in their arrogance of thinking they were going to be in control of Congress for decades to come, didn't actually pass an appropriation for that. And so there was no money appropriated to actually make those payments. And under the Constitution, Congress has to appropriate the money.
Right.
President Obama realized this in 2013 and just before Obamacare really kicked in and said, would you Republicans be willing to pass an appropriation? They said, not a chance in your life are we going to do that. So Obama illegally just said, well, I'll just go ahead and make them anyway.
Yeah.
Trump has continued making these monthly payments. It's about $7 billion a year. He said he would go ahead and make the August payment. If he pulls back on that and doesn't continue making the payments, we will see more insurers drop out.
Do we have any indication that he's inclined to do that?
He's threatened to pull back. He said, essentially, I just may stop making the payments and let this thing collapse, and then Democrats will want to will finally come to the table and actually work with us to fix these problems. On the other hand, Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee is trying to create draft legislation that would, in essence, make the payments legal by appropriating the funds for it, though Mitch McConnell, the president of the head of the Senate, has said he's not entirely sure that a lot of Republicans are going to be willing to step up and make those payments to sort of bail out the system, because it means you're essentially bailing out the system for decades to come.
Yes, that's right. Well, you have a piece out at The Hill, which I think everybody needs to read, saying that the Democrats really have this goal of single payer, which we've known for years now. But some of these Democrats are actually introducing single payer into specific populations and moving toward their real goal here. What is going on? What do we need to know about what the Democrats are up to?
Well, of course, Bernie Sanders has his Medicare for All legislation, essentially putting everybody into Medicare. That's been around for a while, but he's actually getting more attention for it. Then there are other Democrats who are saying, let's have a Medicare buy-in. So people age 55 to 65, before you turn eligible for Medicare at 65, would be able to buy into the Medicare program using Obamacare subsidies. Now, Hillary Clinton had proposed something like this. Al Gore had proposed this back when he was running for president in 2000. And you could make the case then that maybe there was a sense that something like that was needed, because older people oftentimes were having to pay higher premiums and so forth back in 2000. But Obamacare was supposed to fix all those things. It was supposed to make sure that older people got lower premiums by charging younger people more. And it was providing the subsidy. So that problem was supposed to be solved. And yet now Democrats are coming up and saying, you know, it's just very expensive for seniors. They're costing a lot of money. Let's just let them buy into Medicare. And then one other proposal from a senator from Hawaii said, well, why don't we just allow anybody who wants to buy into Medicaid? That's the federal state health insurance program for the poor, which I used to say was the worst health insurance program in the country. Actually, I think the VA is the worst program. But that's kind of where we're all headed, something like a VA system if Obamacare keeps collapsing.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, now, of course, they would have to eventually end all employer insurance coverage and get the country to go along with single payer. How would they actually get that done, though? Is there a path forward for them? Just a matter of waiting for Obamacare to collapse and then say, see, we need single payer, and just expect people will be on board because they want something to be fixed immediately? Or how would they do that, really?
I think they're capitalizing on the chaos around Obamacare and the Republicans' inability to be able to fix the problem. And so some of the Republicans are saying, well, let's just work with Democrats in order to be able to sort of fix the problem. I don't think many Democrats actually want to fix the problem. I think they feel like they're benefiting, and it creates a greater opportunity for them to be able to actually get us to their goal of a single-payer health care system. So even though they might talk about, yeah, let's do something, I think their real goal is to get us over the single-payer system, Medicare or Medicaid for all. And then all you have to do is sort of let the system continue to collapse. People throw up their hands and say, we need some kind of answer, and they'll be there ready to say, look how well Medicare works, let's just put everybody in the system.
Good grief. But what does that do to doctors who are already having problems with reimbursements and all of the problems on the ground with the premium increases and the larger deductibles and the huge copays that so many of us are already experiencing?
You see, that's the most interesting point about this, is that doctors are increasingly, doctors get paid less, about 20% less for Medicare reimbursements on average than private insurance. It's about 45 or 50% less for Medicaid. So most doctors keep their Medicaid and Medicare populations limited to the number in their patient load, so that they can afford to see them and then still have private insurance, kind of make sure it covers the bills. If you put everyone under Medicare, it's going to be very, very difficult for doctors and hospitals and others to be able to see patients, because it just pays so little. So we would find more doctors, I think. We already see doctors dropping out and going to cash-only basis. It's a fair, it's a real small percentage, but I think we'd see a lot more of that then.
Dr. Matthews, why do you think it is that so many Americans now are really on board with socialized medicine as a concept when we have so many examples of its failures in places like Canada? It just, it's astonishing to me. We seem to have fought this a lot more than we're fighting it now.
Because you cannot get the media to own up to the problems of single-payer systems. Single-payer systems have a lot of problems. We have problems. We had problems before Obamacare. What you wanted to do is fix our problems without embracing all the problems of single-payer system. Janet, I get over to England every now and then, and when I go, last time I went, virtually every day for the week I was there, there was a headline article in the newspapers talking about some other problem in the healthcare in the National Health Service, which is a single payer system, of doctors not being able to see patients, patients not being able to get appointments with doctors, patients not getting the treatment, patients too old to get treatment because they weren't considered viable enough and there just wasn't enough money to go around. That goes on constantly over there, and the media just refused to cover it.
Yeah, it's just disgraceful journalistic malpractice. So now we know that there will be bipartisan health care hearings in September, and I know that you talked in your Hill piece about we don't really know right now what Trump actually will do. What do you think President Trump and the clear-thinking Republicans on this issue ought to be doing come September?
I think the only thing they had, their own best choice, is just simply bail out of Obamacare. That is, stop making the payments, let the thing collapse. They're going to get blamed for whatever happens anyway. And let the thing collapse. And then to have, if the Democrats want to have a single payer debate, let's have it right now rather than keep Obamacare limping along for the next several years, throwing billions and billions of taxpayers' dollars at it and not actually fixing a problem. Obamacare is not actuarially sound, and you can't make the thing work without tons of taxpayer dollars.
Dr. Merrill Matthews, thanks for being with us, and thanks for joining us here on Janet Mefford Today.